The Oregon State Police, and we are going to be hearing an agency overview, several presentations, different aspects of the agency budget, and I'll ask Mr. Doug Wilson to begin and ask Ms. Gilbert, Linda Gilbert, to come on up and be ready to follow him.
Madam Chair, first sir, some administrative subcommittee work. First of all, the agenda looks very aggressive, but really it reflects 2 days' worth of hearings. So the bottom half of that Support Services Bureau will likely be here tomorrow. In your packets in front of you, there are some things that that are not necessarily related to state police. The first one is a packet of testimony from when the public testimony on the Criminal Justice Commission that the chair wanted handed out. We had it transcribed from three people, and that's there for your information at the request of the subcommittee chair. The next page is that missing piece from yesterday on the single page comparing that was asked of DPSST. Comparing DPSST's 16-week course with the state police. That was supposed to be part of a packet, and they forgot to include it.
Is that ours?
That is ours on it. And then at the bottom of that pile is the larger packet, is responses from the state police on their the questions that you had during phase one. And so that's there for your reference also. I will be talking briefly off this memo, the usual LFO phase two memo, which paperclip to it is the priority list that you have already seen. I copy that for your information. Last week we had the notebooks delivered to your office. And hopefully you have them with you for the documents on phase two for the state police. In terms of my presentation, I'll keep it short again. Agency mission, program, and customers, we'll let the agency talk about that. It's there for your reference. In terms of budget notes, emergency board actions, and audit findings, there was only one budget note directly associated with the department's budget, and that dealt with a report to the emergency board regarding the distribution of sworn staff between criminal, patrol, and fish and wildlife divisions, which make up the core of the sworn troopers in the agency. Last session's subcommittee had some concerns that the staff was not necessarily distributed between the agency or the divisions, but also geographically across the state. And if you would like that report, I can get it to you. The state police did visit the emergency board a number of times, twice for rebalances. Just like DHS, state police, but on a much smaller basis, the state police and Department of Corrections often rebalances their budget throughout the biennium. So they visited the E-Board twice to deal with that. There was action to restore the funding for the forensics labs or forensics division as a result of ballot measure 30 related cuts. The E-Board fully restored the forensics. There was additional funding for the criminal history record and background check program, the identification services program. I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. And there was also a report relating to Homeland Security funding, which really is not part of this agency anymore. You'll hear that early next week from Homeland Security. But at that time, the state police and legally still have that under their umbrella at this time. In addition, in the January board, the state police were used as a vehicle to fund money in communities for gang intervention in Multnomah County. No specific audits for the state police except as part of the larger statewide single audit. There were no reportable findings, but there were three conditions that the audits division thought should be at least raised in terms of corrective actions, dealing mainly with payroll, dealing with having employees have too much responsibility throughout the phases, generally in accounting manuals. You don't want the same person authorizing or writing the check that is reconciling the check to put in some checks and balances. Those were the kinds of things that they found, and I would venture an assumption or a hypothesis that one reason for this problem state police is they have very few sort of central administrative staff. Those have been cut over the past few biennium, and this is probably an indication of the effect of doing that. In terms of expenditure history, it's self-explanatory there. If you'll notice, really, over that three biennial period, the total funding, and this is total funds, has not gone up very much, even though employee compensation issues generally drive budgets, which interprets to mean that over the same period, positions were cut, since this is significantly a personnel-related driven budget. So at the top of page 3, there is a chart that I've used before that shows over the last three biennia reductions in the number of positions by division. You'll see the noticeable decline in the patrol, criminal investigations, information management and LEDs, and human resources, all pretty much general funded driven. You won't see the same level of decreases in those that are other fund fees or contracts, examples given by Fish and Wildlife Division and the Gaming Division. Overall, they've lost close to 300 positions between the 01-03 biennium and the 05-07 biennium. Major policy and budget issues that the department will likely touch on that you may want to ask questions on if they haven't is, number one, the governor's budget includes a $70 million fund shift from general fund to lottery funds for patrol and the general fund portion of fish and wildlife. I think there's still discussions going on whether that shift is the proper way to go. It doesn't necessarily mean that there would be any reduction as a result of that shift. If we shift it back to general fund, it just means lottery funds would likely be used in a place in the budget where lottery funds are already used, and the option would be then to reinsert the general fund for these purposes. The governor's budget includes the elimination of 21 detectives or investigators in the criminal division, but at the same time adds back 9 positions in the department, 8 of which are in the criminal division, for the governor's meth initiative. And one issue that I've talked to the governor's office about is to make sure that this is the proper configuration of staff for the meth initiative, or whether there would be a different way of configuring the staff. Governor's budget does not address a number of issues identified in the rebalance from last November, including things like gasoline prices, which actually have gotten significantly worse for the agency with the gas price increases, temporary employees, double-filled positions, overtime, and equipment maintenance contracts. Those are examples of some of the problems that are not really addressed in the governor's budget. The largest, the governor's budget also makes a change, our funding shift from SNS to personal services to fund a number of positions. And this exasperates a problem that the agency already faces with not an insufficient amount of services and supply. Probably the largest hole is one that, as we work through it during the session, seems to get worse, and that is sufficient funding for the Identification Services Program. These are the folks that do criminal background checks, instant gun checks, those kinds of criminal records reviews. And the funding for that program, general fund, has continued to fall, and the agency has returned to the E-Board, had a little funding put in for 03-05. to make sure they could get through the end of the biennium. They also increased fees where they could administratively for, like, other state agencies, nonprofits, some of those fees. And they had a bill introduced that increased the fees on those they could not raise administratively, mostly the concealed handgun fee, the instant check for gun owners, and the expungement fees. And I'm not sure whether that bill will actually get through the legislature. It does have some issues in it that are more political in nature than that could stop it. And if that's the case, there's probably about a $6 million hole or greater than that in this budget that's not addressed in the governor's budget. As all the discussion on number six that we've had already as a subcommittee with Department of Public Safety Standards and Training around the integration of the state police's recruit school into the operations of the, or through the basic law enforcement training provided through DPSST, that's an ongoing issue. And finally, in terms of the co-chairs, both of them restore the $3 million reduction. Or both of them make, excuse me, a $3 million reduction to the patrol and fish and wildlife divisions to provide funding for agency infrastructure and the hole in ID services, identification services, and they restore the 21 detective positions in the criminal division that were cut in the governor's budget. The House co-chair further restores a little over $1 million for reductions in operational support, training, and the general fund component of the Boxing and Wrestling Commission. The Senate version does not make that restoration.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wilson, so in paragraph 7, the co-chairs restored the 21 that the governor
that is right.
Criminal investigators, so we've got those back, but we've still got the 9 meth
conditions. Yes, right. In addition, the House...
The 5.4.
The House co-chair has additional money
talk about
for
that.
Meth, and I didn't... That doesn't necessarily mean it goes to the state police. So I think it's 5.4 million or 5.1. I think that's a pool of money that is going to sit there, and the Judiciary Committee folks, Ways and Means folks, will work on trying to prioritize the use of that money.
Madam Chair, I talked in the offline. I'd like the state police to talk to us how they would use that 5.4 million to fight meth, of how they would man it or something, so we can maybe get into that when we get into the operational discussion.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Chair, unless there's questions, that completes my presentation.
Representative Tapp.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. I'm hopeful that when we get to the section on the ID procedures and those costs that we can have a more conversation about that, if not now, when the agency gets to that point.
And I've made notice to the agency or suggested they spend some time on that during their presentation. This problem was coming to light during sort of the final stages of putting the governor's budget together, so the governor really didn't have time to incorporate it because there was not full knowledge of it at that time. So it does sort of leave a problem for this subcommittee to deal with.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Good afternoon, Ms. Gilbert.
Good afternoon, Chair Gordley, members of the subcommittee. For the record, Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. Working from this document. On the second page, we see the two standard pies. This time, we're looking at $230.8 million total funds for the state police budget, and that is just under 10% of the public safety program area budget. With respect to general fund and lottery fund, the total is $173 million, which is about 75% of the state police budget. Moving to page 3. This is the budget by fund type, and the main message of this page is that about 75%, again, is general fund and lottery fund. There's some other funds from fees from other state agencies, contracts with state agencies, and fees from individuals and non-government entities, as well as a small amount of other funds from certificate of participation proceeds. Federal funds would include grants, and then the lottery funds are a mix of about $6 million in Measure 66 money and the rest from presumably line games. The next page shows the agency by program units. If this were a clock, we'd be starting at about, 2 o'clock until almost 6 o'clock, looking at patrol services as the largest section, or the largest program unit, and then moving clockwise, we next have Fish and Wildlife and then Criminal Services, and these three units are where just nearly all of the sworn staff are. Next, we have Forensic Services at about 11%. Medical examiners, a little under 2%. Information management at about 8%. Gaming enforcement down to about 3.7%. And finally, human resources / training / criminal justice division, which in a technical adjustment will be changed to administrative services. The next page is the budget by category. This agency is mostly personnel, therefore it's not a surprise that 72% of the budget is for personal services, 21% services and supplies. Capital outlay is about 3.8%, and most of that is automobile purchases. Special payments, 2%, debt service, 1%. The following page is a short history here. This is a number version of the chart that my colleague Mr. Wilson presented. Looking at the final column, the change from 2003-05, we have wild things going on with respect to percentage changes. Mostly that is a result of moving the Office of Homeland Security, as it is now, out and proposing it as a separate agency. But another impact, of course, is the $70 million fund shift from general fund to lottery funds that makes such a difference in the general fund budget. Finally, the next six pages will address assumptions in the governor's budget, policy packages, cost drivers, fee issues, and finally, the kinds of technical adjustments that the subcommittee will be looking at. On page 7 are the assumptions that were used in preparing the governor's budget. As you've heard, there's lottery support for patrol troopers and for 18 of the Fish and Wildlife sworn staff. Patrol troopers are kept level, at the same level, the same number as 2003-05. The same is true of the Fish and Wildlife staff. There are 101 criminal detectives. That's quite a bit fewer than 2003-05. As was stated, there's a methamphetamine initiative which has dedicated detectives, a sergeant and seven troopers, and one forensic scientist as well. There were no reductions to forensics or the medical examiner divisions. On page 8 and 9, there's an overview of the policy packages. And considering state police, excluding the Homeland Security spinoff, as it were, the agency takes a net reduction of $3 million total funds, and of that amount, $2.5 million is general and lottery fund. They lose 29 positions, 22.66 full-time equivalent. Additions in the governor's budget, as we've said, there's money for the meth initiative, lottery funding for the troopers. There's one fee-supported trooper that's added for the tow program. There are proceeds from certificates of participation for 171 new intoxilizers. And there is one fee-supported position for the medical examiner. It's a morgue attendant, and the fees are from Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah County. Moving to page 8.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Gilbert, was the COP revenue that we saw before from this sale? If we went back to the graph on the pie graph, was the COP revenue the revenue gained by the sale of those for the intoxilizers?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna.
You have a small amount of COP revenue listed?
It's only $1.6 million, I think.
On page 3 on the graph, if you look at to the right, it says COP proceeds.
Oh, right.
Is that what that is?
Yes.
Okay.
1.6.
Ms. Gilbert, I'm trying to reconcile information on page 8 regarding the lottery funding for troopers, 300 troopers.
trying to reconcile that with what Mr. Wilson shared with us about the governor's recommended budget at 329 patrol.
Madam Chair, the difference is the other ones are other funded through contracts.
Right. Madam Chair, most of that contract money is with the Department of Transportation for truck safety on the highways.
Let's continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 10, cost drivers, the first listed is methamphetamine, other controlled substance abuse. This is certainly a driver for the patrol, criminal services, and forensics divisions. Identity theft is another cost driver for criminal services. For fish and wildlife, there's the endangered and protected species listings, as well as actions of the Fish and Wildlife Commission. For the medical examiner, the driver would be unattended or suspicious deaths that need to be investigated. The gaming division, those drivers are the activity with respect to casino gaming, tribal casino gaming, and lottery activity. Forensics has an impact from district attorney's prosecution decisions with respect to processing and presenting evidence. Patrol, of course, is affected by the number of drivers on Oregon's highways. And finally, as was mentioned, fuel or gasoline costs certainly has an impact on patrol. The next page discusses or overviews the fee issue that we had already been talking about in the identification services section. We're on page 11. In addition to what Mr. Wilson said, the idea here, or the goal, was to make this section self-supporting and to do it by examining exactly what kind of work it took to process each of the 10 different fees that were under consideration. And having done that, the agency came up with what the correct fees should be for each of them, for the 7 fees that are established by rule or changed by rule, and for those fees that are done by statute. And I think 1 or possibly 2 fees actually came down just a little bit. The whole package depends on all 10 of the fees passing, including the statutory ones, and those are the ones that might be in some doubt now, and that would lead to a shortfall that we might have in the past supported with general fund. It and the ending balances have eroded, and so we're now at a point where either these fees have to happen, or we might be looking at general fund, or a different way of managing the permitting process. Next page are the kinds of things that you'll be considering with respect to technical adjustments. Some of them are terribly technical, which is just aligning the amounts of funds transferred between state police and Homeland Security. It's always an interesting process to pull off a part of an agency and make it a separate agency. There will be some rent expense and position reallocation from a human resources division to other divisions. Some grants have some carry forward that need, or some carryover dollars that need limitation in 0507. And another thing that we'll want to discuss is to establish or to explore establishing an overhead expense allocation among the various divisions. And with that, my presentation is completed, and I will take questions if there are any.
Questions?
Madam Chair, just real quickly, Linda Schiffer or Ms. Gilbert brought it up. My bar graph on mine excludes any of the divisions, Fire Marshal, Office of Emergency Management, that are transferred out to Homeland Security. So it's only looking at those divisions that remain in state police.
Representative was not look quizzical.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. We talked about it before. I think this advice from members of the committee were that we don't have to worry about where that's legal right for the use lottery funds. It'll come out of general fund and not to support this. So we're gonna have the same situation we had this morning in education. We're going to be able to approve this budget or work this budget until we know what the legal ruling is on the using lottery money.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if it's a legal or a co-chair decision or whatever it might be.
But you're right that if this is a policy issue that still has yet to be made, that it would be difficult to work this budget completely until that decision is made.
So just kind of file that one away, knowing that we will come back to it. We have to come back to it. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since we are all Education Committee members also that are here, it looks like I may be returning that budget to the committee next week. So we might need to do another adjustment in it. It's not your issue. But given the magnitude, I would guess, of the size of the state police's budget, it's probably we're not going to get the okay to move it till very, very close to the end of the process.
I would say that's pretty obvious from where I sit. Good afternoon, Superintendent.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Looks like you're feeling a whole lot better.
Yes, ma'am.
We're glad about that. Where would you like to start with the overview?
Well, if it would be acceptable to you and the other members of the committee, Madam Chair, I would propose to take very little of your time myself at this point. I had my opportunity earlier, and I probably will look for some opportunity to make some closing remarks at the end. And what I would like to do, aside from just assuring the committee that my staff and I will make our very best effort to answer any of the questions that come up in the subsequent discussions in here, but that we move forward to having some of our subject matter experts under, and as we start, will be the Operations Services Bureau, which is commanded by Major Dan Durbin. We proceed with getting into those conversations so that I don't take up your time when you might best be able to use it asking questions or interacting with the people that are here to talk about specific programs. So if it pleases the committee, that's what I would propose to do. Thank you, Doug. I have to start bringing my own. But, you know, we're happy to be here. We acknowledge the circumstances under which our budget discussion is occurring. We're asked a lot of questions frequently that we don't have an answer for either, obviously. Those decisions are to be made by you and the rest of the Legislative Assembly, but we're here to talk about our budget and our programs, and we've got all the people queued up and ready to go.
Very good. Thank you again. Are there questions or comments for the good superintendent before we move on to operations? Okay. Thank you very much. Major...
Dan Durbin.
Dan Durbin, come on up. And might as well bring Captain Bruce Karn forward as well. Good to see you both.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to direct us to where we might follow along in our notebooks, that would be helpful.
Where we're going to start today, Madam Chair, is under the tab for Fish and Wildlife. During the next 3.5 hours or so of our allotted time for the Phase 2 testimony, you'll primarily hear from the 8 division commanders which represent the operations of the Support Services Bureau. Now, we intend to provide just a brief summary of the report that has been provided to the subcommittee members, and that testimony is going to touch in the following areas: budget drivers and environmental factors, historical changes, cost control measures, professional services and contracts, budget detail, and then the governor's recommended budget. You've already been introduced to Captain Karn. At the conclusion of the Patrol Services Division testimony, I would like to address the question that was posed by Representative Wisnant regarding how the division or department would use additional funds to address the methamphetamine problem. So with your permission, Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce Captain Bruce Karn of the Fish and Wildlife Division to speak about his division.
Hello, Dan.
Thank you, Senator Gordley, Chair Gordley, and representatives of the committee. I want to thank you again. My name is Bruce Karn, for the record, Captain of the Fish and Wildlife Division, State Police. As the Major Durbin has said, I believe you have before you the document that I'm going to be referring to. What I've done is, for the interest of time, is I've made kind of a summary of some of the bullets and so forth, and again, please feel free to ask questions as I go along. I would like, with the permission of the committee, to first like to answer a question that was raised during the priority phase of our agency presentation. I believe it was had to do with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife revenue increase and what portion of that had gone to help fund the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division. And what I've done is I've given you two graphs, if you want to refer to those. One of them shows the revenue increase from license and tag sales from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and then it shows the money transfer to the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife for enforcement. And the second graph will show the actual percentage of license and tag sales.
You're in the wrong book.
Okay.
It's the other book.
All right.
Yeah, I'm going to get a different book.
All right. Just be at ease here for a moment.
I'm sure which page are we on?
I believe we're on page one. The Fish and Wildlife presentation.
Madam Chair, there may be a bit of confusion. What the agency did was provide you with a brand new notebook, and I don't even your offices, which was delivered, I think, on Friday.
Yeah.
To you. There's also the first notebook from Phase One that has much the same material in
just
it.
Just so we're kind to our staff. Pretty difficult to tell. we can't blame them for that.
Chair Gordy, members of the committee, I apologize for the confusion.
It's fine.
Okay.
No problem. Thank you.
But I believe we're on page two of the document. That graph will actually show the license revenue that was transferred, the percentage of license revenue transferred to the Oregon State Police. We've given you about a 25-year history of that transfer and where it is in the projected 2005-2007 budget for the Fish and Wildlife Division. As we all know, the current population of Oregon has increased, from 2.6 million, that would be the next graph, to 3.5 million people in the last 24 years. Recently I read where Oregon is projected to be number 10th in the nation on growth for the future. That trend of growth will increase the demand for consumptive and recreational use of our wildlife and natural resources, creating a growing demand for recreational use of our parks, our wilderness areas, and public lands. Now, there is not or no way there'll be sufficient resources to meet that demand. It's going to take an increased law enforcement that will have to be provided to adequately protect these resources. Some of these resources that I'm talking about, we can start with some of the commercial end of it that has a direct impact on a lot of our cities and commercial entities over on the coast and of course through the state. And as certain marketable fish are exploited or over harvested, we've seen recently where new fisheries have developed where before there was no pressure on these species, and then therefore with all the regulations and rules that have to be adopted and in place to sustain the yield, it creates a more of a demand on fish and wildlife enforcement in general. The health, we've seen this last year, I believe it was over on the coast, where during Labor Day, where the brown fish was shut off and a huge impact on the economy on some of the coastal towns. The groundfish populations, will limit sport and commercial fishing opportunities, and of course they have a devastating impact on the coastal economy. And the Fish and Wildlife Officer is the one who helps regulate and make sure that the over-harvest doesn't occur and, to, of course, to do the investigations on those cases. The struggle is going to be, of course, for all of us, is to maintain the current populations but yet conserve our natural resources. This situation, of course, is going to have to be done through additional regulations and restrictions on the use of these resources. That leads me into the water issues. Water availability and quality will be the primary driving issue behind environmental protection. We've seen the recent decisions that come out from the Attorney General's office regarding navigability, some of the disputes between landowners and recreationalists and hunters and fishermen on the rivers. That'll be one of the drivers that will take up some of our time. Waterborne recreation will continue to increase at a significant rate in relation to the increasing population and healthy economy, and producing a further demand for shoreline development of residences and, of course, service facilities.
This presents problems of crowding, antisocial behavior, resulting in safety concerns and quality of life deterioration. And, of course, right now we're looking at drought situations. As they continue in the areas of the state, this will limit the lawful recreation use of our public lands. It will increase law enforcement will be needed to provide adequate protection of these resources. Some of the budget drivers for our division are not inherent to just our division, but I think you're going to see a common thread throughout our agency. And, of course, that's salary and benefit increases. Costs have gone up, increased costs of patrol vehicles. The radios, the technology to go in these vehicles have gone up in our boats. The increased cost of specialized equipment as technology and needs change. Increased fuel costs, I believe that was already talked about earlier. Currently right now, for example, our airplanes, we're paying $3.30 a gallon. The cost of operating our planes has gone up from 2001 to 2004, has gone up $4 an hour. That's just an example. People are residing in traditional wildlife habitat places, and it places a strain on the cohabitation and generates complaints regarding human and property concerns. The historical changes for our division, you can look at in your graphs. There should be one page that shows four graphs. I've gone back three bienniums, and you can see that in the last 25 years of our division, we've seen an actual reduction in our staffing levels in our division from 124 down to 120. Specifically for the last three bienniums, the last three graphs show the percentage of funding and their source that make up our budget and the shifting that's occurred because the majority of our budget is dedicated funding. What we have done to try to control cost measures is our officers don't work a set schedule as do some of the other officers in the patrol division. We have an itinerary where the officer basically determines, based on the cooperative enforcement planning and, of course, the resource concerns, sets his schedule to make sure that he's out there in the optimum time to enforce the fish and wildlife regulations. We've also recently purchased a data collection system for the officers that they can enter online rather than have to hire somebody, which was typically in the past at headquarters, to enter all the data and statistics that our officers send in every month. We now are in test phase this month, should be activated sometime next month, where the officers will be able to enter that information right from their computer screens. And that information will be available. It'll be real time and real data, and it won't be any more lag or a person sitting there entering data onto a screen at headquarters. I already spoke on in 1989. We entered into a cooperative enforcement planning process with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Through that process, our priorities are determined. What our officers should be focusing on during a certain time of the year. And so these officers, when they're going out in the field, don't have to get in their trucks and decide, where should I go today? That's already been predetermined. They have a plan, they have a vision, and they go right to work. And so that's been really useful for us in interacting with the biologists of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to help create that planning process and also citizen groups. Conclusion, all these concerns that I stated create additional demands for law enforcement to maintain Oregon's natural resources as a stable and equitable resource to ensure that all users and groups the opportunity to have a quality recreational experience and the opportunity to participate in a commercial enterprise involving Oregon's natural resources and to provide jobs while ensuring that Oregon is still a desirable place to live. The future of Oregon will be determined by the investment that we make in our children, our economy, and our quality of life. Within this vision, two of the six priorities identified by the governor stress the high value of enhancing and protecting our natural resources and that public safety is essential for our citizens. And I believe the Fish and Wildlife Division members play a vital role in each of these principles as we enter the 21st century. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions or comments?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Please.
Thank you. I guess one of the questions, because you talked about this in the advised of the cost of fuel, we obviously know, but in your department, that's a big ticket item. How much money does the state police overall have for fuel,
and what is the increase in price? Are we looking at a shortfall of $100,000 or $50,000 for what you guesstimated for the fuel price? It could be.
Chair Gordley, Representative Wisnant, maybe somebody would be better to answer that question. But my understanding is that for every penny, we're budgeted at $1.30 and it's at $2.33. For every penny that the price of gas goes up, it costs the agency $17,000. So it's probably a couple million over the biennium.
Mr. Wilson?
Madam Chair, I don't think they pay the $2.33 that you and I do at the pump, because I think they get at least the state tax taken off. I'm not sure of the federal. So it's not the full $2.33 or $2.38, something less than that.
Okay.
So are we still, Madam Chair? Mr. Wilson, are we still looking at, $100,000, $200,000?
I think it'd be significantly more than $100,000 or $200,000. We'll get that information put together as a response to a question.
Because they're either going to have to, have less miles on patrol or find the money somewhere else.
If
they're paying officers to patrol, we don't want them sitting on the side of the road with a radar gun.
Right.
Major Griffin, did you have additional information?
Well, I was just going to ask, you want to address that later?
I'm sorry.
No, this is good. Let's get the answer now so we keep it in context.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Ken Weiss, Budget Director for State Police. Our data indicates that we drive about 1 million miles a month, all vehicles within State Police. We're budgeted at about $1.27 for the current biennium, and with the inflation, we go to about $1.30 a gallon next biennium. And as the captain indicated, for every penny increase, it's about $17,000 for the biennium if we sustain that higher rate for the full biennium. The $2.33 is a monthly, is the most recent month's analysis, netting out the deduction that we don't have to pay because we're a government agency. So it is a real issue. The budget instructions did not allow for a sufficient increase. I don't think anybody anticipated it. We didn't ask for an exception in our budget process at the time when this budget was put together. But it is something that is going to have a substantial impact given the number of miles we drive agency-wide and the current trends in gas prices. And in terms of the actual dollars, I'd request that you give us some time and we'll give you some hard dollars on that cost difference between what's budgeted and what we think the costs are going to be if the trend stays the same.
Very good. Senator Devlin and then Representative Hanna.
Just to clarify, what is your exemption from state and federal taxes?
I think it's about 24 cents, and I think the exemption is the federal tax.
State tax is now 24 cents.
Okay.
It has been 24 cents for a long time now.
Right. Okay. It's that exemption. It's 24 cents is the reduced amount.
And then your average price is still?
Our weighted average. And the reason I say weighted average is we buy our fuel from different sources. We have about four vendors that provide services, either through gas cards or through Pacific Pride. And they vary. But so our accountants have done what we call a weighted average, and it's $2.33 after the netting of the 24-cent tax exemption.
For sake of clarity there, I think in your exemption, because the distributor actually pays the tax, they get to take that what they sell to you off of what they return to the state,
correct.
Or off of what they pay to the state.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, that's correct. And let me make clear, too, that was last month's weighted average. That is not what we've been experiencing for the full biennium. And that's why I wanted to be able to give you some specific detail on the actual cost.
Representative Hanna?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your question begs another question. Does that include aircraft fuel? Is that how you're getting that high of number?
The Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, the analysis that I was speaking to was just the fuel cost for auto vehicles. We have separate costs for diesel and separate costs for airplane fuel. And I don't have that data available with me, but we can include that cost.
I mean, I know you all know we're sitting looking at calculators saying, I'm not sure I've paid $257 yet. I mean, if you added the $233 and $24, I don't know where, I mean, it just seems like a very high cost given even the retail market. In Oregon, and I'm driving a bunch back and forth, and I haven't paid that much. So I'm just wondering where you're...
Madam Chair, my understanding is, that, again, that's the result of the fuel bills that we receive in, and we're subject to this analysis. I think some of the vehicles are burning fuel beyond just regular gas. I think some of them are burning a premium. And again, that's the sort of thing that we'll bring forward in our analysis.
Madam Chair, follow up. My original question really is, when you bring that information back, the percentage of your budget that fuel is.
The million miles per month, are those actual miles, or is that based on some formula?
Those, Madam Chair, are actual miles. Monthly we receive mileage reports around the state from all vehicles. We're required to submit that as part of our risk management reports.
All right. Senator Devlin, were you completed? Did you complete your questions?
Yes, I just think we can save the detail for when we get the analysis back.
All right. Please, thank you very much. And please continue. Were there further questions for Captain Karn? Did you have anything additional, Major?
No, we're prepared to proceed to the priority.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I actually have a question, and I'm not sure, maybe I missed it here, but if you'd allow me back, Captain Karn, to the percentage of Department of Fish and Wildlife license revenue transferred to OSP contracts. It's page 2, I think. What determines the percentage returned? I mean, it's moved up and down. What determines that percentage? And if you overlay that graph with the total revenue from license, the total license revenue, would the revenue be going up? Because the population line's going up, but are more people buying licenses? And I know we've had an increase in the fee, the charge. So would the revenue be going up at the same pace this is going down? And who sets what part comes back?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I'm not familiar with the past bieniums. I know that our department works very closely with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and we actually request the amount of money that we would need to transfer to fund the division. So to answer the other, maybe another part of your question about their revenue going up, their revenue increase in the 2003 biennium, you can see the increase there was directly tied to programs that they have identified that were underfunded and received funding for. Director Ball has come to me several times and asked, you know, what do you need from us? How is the funding? And he's asked about our funding. And we have not asked for more than what we received, I guess I should say. So they have gone up in revenue 18% from 01 to 07, and we have also gone up 18%. So the percentage of transfer has maintained the same the last two bienniums.
Mr. Wilson?
Madam Chair, really, the first part, I think, of Representative Hanna's question is who makes the decision. It's really, you know, part of the budget process. So in a sense, this subcommittee, in conjunction with Natural Resources, in a sense, mm-hmm. helps move along with that decision. So if you suddenly said, we want to increase the number of officers or troopers that are in the Fish and Wildlife Division, you'd have to have a conversation with them, you know, Chair Morgan and others on whether Fish and Wildlife would have that available, and they would have to reprioritize within Fish and Wildlife's budget to make sure you'd have enough to transfer.
Madam Chair?
Certainly.
So there is a conversation that takes place about that, because that revenue line looks good. I mean, they're on the right track there somehow, and if we're having trouble getting folks to the road, or to the boat or to the wherever you are in whatever vehicle it is and what you have to do, that might be a conversation we would have.
Would you like to flag that, Representative Hanna?
I have, as a matter of fact. Thank you.
Well, I think we're ready to move on, Captain Karn. I want to thank you again for your time and hard work and presentation. Mr. Wilson?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out one other thing with this division. If you take a look at page 7, mm-hmm. which is the page with the four graphs on it, I want to make sure you understand that the lottery fund for this division are not only the new line games. There's also a significant amount of ballot measure 66 funds, which make up this division. Actually, if you take a look at the 0305 biennium, the lottery funds there represent the ballot measure 66 lottery funds, and the general fund represents the amount that's the new funding from line games assumed in the governor's budget. So that will just give you an idea of the breakdown.
Yeah, thank you for making that that point, that distinction. Thank you again.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And the director of the criminal division?
Madam Chair, I have to apologize to the captain. I think I spelled his name wrong on the general, so I apologize up front.
No problem, Mr. Smith.
Very good. Touché.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Captain O'Murray, Director of the Criminal Investigation Division.
And would you like to give us the correct spelling?
M-O-U-E-R-Y. Three vowels in a row, believe it or not.
Okay. Thank you so much.
So where's the 17%?
Yes. You have my budget testimony in front of you. I'm going to kind of probably just capture pieces out of it. Please feel free to ask me any questions during that or after. I will start in the budget drivers and environmental factors that affect my division mostly.
Sir, if I could ask you to hold on just for a moment.
Yes.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence here. And I'm sorry to Mr.
Captain.
Captain, may I, Madam Chair, just go back to this for a moment?
Yes.
Did I understand you to say that your revenue increased 18%? That the revenue of Fish and Game increased 18% and yours did as well?
No, sir. The percentage increased, not the revenue itself. The money transfer, the increase in transfer was 18%, not so much the revenue itself.
Madam Chair, follow up. So,
certainly.
You went from 16.9 to 17.3. What period are you referencing that the increase was that much?
Just trying to get in more money from the fish.
Well, I'm trying to understand how it works. And
I, Chair Gordley, Representative Hanna, I had my figures jotted down. I believe that was from the 99.01 to the current.
Well, you were getting 17% in 99.01, and in 0305 you got 16.9, and the proposal 17.3.
Right. So the increase has remained the same. As far as 18% of their revenue is a lot more than our 18% of transfer.
Okay. Because in money, you only got 2% more.
Correct.
So it really...
So it's
okay.
18% of their increase.
Their increase isn't doing you any good, is what I see. I mean, their increase hasn't gotten you more money.
It's gone... Chair Gordley, Representative Hanna, has gone to identified programs. That's correct. Not to us.
Okay.
Okay, so, Madam Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you. Because if you look at the four charts on page 7, I mean, you know, you got it. It's an increase from 9901 to 12 is a significant increase, and the same thing for the next year, but then you only got 300,000 more, you know, this 0507 biennium. So,
Chair Gordley, Representative Wisner, that was just a 2.4 COLA general increase that we got.
thank you for coming back, helping us there.
Captain Karn, don't leave the room. We are about to be done with this afternoon.
Okay.
And we are on page one of the criminal division presentation.
Yes, Madam Chair. Okay. Captain Ed Maurer again for the record. Budget drives and environmental factors, I'll go through some of them that impact the division as far as on workload. The first one I have listed is our sex offender registration. We're averaging probably about 54 new sex offenders that we're required to register each month. Naturally, that adds up to a caseload from within the unit. Fluctuation between the caseload anywhere from 1,693 to 2,371 per admin spec that I have. The 2371 increases usually when we have a vacancy in the unit and another admin spec has to pick up that load till we can get somebody trained, which takes about 3 months worth of time to be able to step back in and assume some of those case files. Like I said, right now there are probably 15,668 sex offenders that are listed in the database. We're a little over 2,500 are residing out of state, and 1,200 are still incarcerated in institutions in Oregon. Last year, to work from within, because of the caseload, excuse me.
We have some water on the way to you, and if you'd like
fine.
To...
I don't think the superintendent touched his mask. Oh, he didn't? Okay, thank you. I'll get... Excuse me about that.
Not a problem.
I reassigned an admin spec 1, which was a resource data specialist position, into the SOR unit just to help out with a caseload. Some of the duties that the resource data specialist did was dispersed among investigative support personnel, our analysts and stuff. We also worked with Oregon Department of Justice Intel Center and asked if they would be willing to take up a lot of the inquiries that our detectives inquire about people in the field. And this position was one of those ones that were able to track people down through these various databases, through magazine subscriptions, credit checks, and so forth on that. So we did beef up the unit internally without asking for additional positions. The other basic usually cost driver, we usually end up buying filing cabinets about 2 every 6 months just to keep up with the amount of paperwork that's coming in. We are looking at some digital imaging systems right now to see what the cost of that would be to try to mitigate. Just we're running out of room up at headquarters. State institution investigations, over the last several years, with the DOC and OIA capacity increasing around the state, with Measure 11 issues and the building of institutions around the state, where I have detectives where those institutions are, we pretty much are on point to do a lot of the criminal investigations that happen inside the institutions. I listed a lot of the institutions, what we respond to there, state hospital, Department of Corrections, and OIA facilities around. The biggest thing about this is, probably to explain, is when you have, I use an instance, if you have the Madras facility that would come online, or the Lakeview facility may come online, I have detectives in Bend, 2 of them right now, that work a lot of the major crimes and child sex abuse, things like that, as well as in Klamath. When those sites come on point, cases that happen from within that institution immediately start hitting that office. So therefore, it's kind of another caseload that that office didn't have that now we're picking up and absorbing, trying to blend in. And actually, when you do that, we have to kind of prioritize what we kind of get to and what we don't get to in each of those areas and work that out with the local law enforcement agencies. So the point, with continuation of the expansion of the DOC institutions, again, that impacts pretty much our case workload from the existing resources. Again, in the year 2003, our major crime sections investigated over 400 state institution cases case-wide. Since March of 2003, when we were reduced by 20 detective positions, we still assumed 470 investigations conducted last year. What some of the things we did, we sat down with Department of Corrections and tried to come up with some efficiencies on what we could do. We involved the Marion County District Attorney's Office. We did a pilot project by entering into an MOU where the Department of Corrections Investigations Unit would do some of the smaller, minor-type crimes that occur within the state penitentiary, such as inmate work crews that may involve supplying contraband by inmates, or if they do a cell shakedown, they find a weapon, the DOC investigations unit would handle the report writing of that and forward it to the DA's office for potential prosecution depending on the DA's protocols. Doing that, we've done it since June through December of 04. It has worked very well. We're thinking about looking at doing it statewide. What we did is we sat down with DOC on a pretty intense two-day training period and trained them on some of the aspects of the investigations. We still do a lot of the search warrant affidavits and more of the intense type investigations, but this has released some of the burden. Our guys go over and pick up evidence every day on just contraband found in a cell. There might not be any prosecution on those types of deals. Computer crimes. Obviously, with computer crimes and technology today, the problem is trying to stay up with the bad guys. Most of the stuff, what computers are being used now with illegal transactions, we're seeing drugs being sold over the internet, money laundering. You have the chat rooms, obviously, with juveniles involved, child pornography, identity theft, hacking of state systems or government systems, victimization of young juveniles. We pretty much do. There are some law enforcement agencies that have their own computer forensics people. There are some that don't. I have one in Salem, and I have one assigned to the FBI's brand new regional computer facility up in Portland, which is a state-of-the-art facility that does a lot of the child pornography type juvenile victimization crimes. A lot of these things, when they do come in, the biggest problem is because evidence requires us to mirror the actual computer database, we have to go out and buy additional hard drives to mirror what's on that computer. And some of these computers that come in, on one particular case, we may get 12 computers or 12 hard drives, which we buy 12 hard drives to mirror so the detectives can analyze that and try to recover data that somebody may have thought that they had been able to delete. So we're always, the technology issues, especially with the new computers coming out, every 2 years we're buying brand new software, the state of the art to be able to recover data on these newer type systems. And obviously, you know, with technology today, with cell phones, PDAs, and all those types of deals, I have to have a specific detective trained to be able to do Apple Macintosh computers versus the regular IBM types, because there's a difference in how computers operate. So the biggest benefit that we had by putting a body in that FBI Northwest Regional Computer Forensics Laboratory is they provided free training for us and bought us state-of-the-art equipment that we're able to use and still continue to do some of these cases around the state. Just to give you an example, in 2004, the two computer crimes detectives responded to 98 computer crimes analysis requests from various law enforcement agencies. They were able to complete 82 of them. One case involved 8 CPUs and 12 hard drives. Another intense one was the Brooke Wilbur case that we were asked to also conduct and do. And again, the highest percentage of the computer crimes we're seeing today is child pornography, child sex abuse, and identity theft. Previously, the previous biennium, I did have a total of 4 computer crimes detectives. The next topic, drug enforcement. Rather than harp on the meth epidemic, the legislature is doing an outstanding job trying to address that. Appreciate the support on that. The biggest thing, what we've noticed, like I said, the crystal methamphetamine coming up the I-5 corridor is beginning to increase. And what's interesting is we are starting to see a little bit of the cocaine starting to come back, which we haven't seen in a while. That's probably been over the last 4 to 6 months. We're seeing meth seizures combined with cocaine seizures, which we're not sure if that's because of that methamphetamine is getting harder to get, or we're having a little bit of a disruption effect on that market, or if they're trying to re-emerge it back again. But one thing, obviously, in the last several months, some of the other things that we're very concerned about, for those of you that do get Statesman Journal, there's a 2-pound heroin seizure here about 2 months ago by Salem Police Department on a routine traffic stop. That leads us some concern to have that much heroin floating in the Salem area. What we've seen in the past is when you do have meth users who decide to get tired of meth and decide to rebalance themselves mentally from being up here, the heroin kind of smooths things out. We saw that happen in Josephine County when meth became a pretty hot topic down there. A lot of the meth users switched over and became heroin users. The other recent thing that we've seen some major outdoor marijuana grows that are linked to international organized crime. These are huge marijuana grows. We had 3 of them over in eastern Oregon. One where a hunter who was bow hunting was actually chased out of the grow site by some armed individuals. One of the ones that we stumbled into had already been completely harvested, and these are grows ranging from 3,000 to 4,000 plants. That's telling me that there's not a lot of stuff that's getting worked in eastern Oregon, not a lot of marijuana flights being done. They're choosing these hard canyon areas, and they're moving people in campsites who are actually tending to those plants year-round and harvesting and then getting out. And these cases are tied to, to the neighboring of Idaho, and they're tying back down to California. As far as in the major crime section, what impacts us, again, is part of the larger complex cases that involve state agencies involving fraud, embezzlement, or official misconduct. We respond to these as quickly as possible. We have a very close relationship working with the Oregon Attorney General's Office Criminal Justice Division. We've partnered up on some cases. We recently sat down with the Oregon Secretary of State's Audit Unit because of the expertise they have with their CPA backgrounds. They have assisted us immensely on a couple of cases where reams and reams of paper financial records, they were able to go through and tell us what they were seeing, which helped our criminal case. Naturally, my investigators aren't CPAs, and when they start looking at numbers, it's kind of like me, they kind of gloss over. So the asset that they've been able to provide us has been immense on some particular cases. Some of these cases, like I said, involving ODOT, Oregon Department of Economic Development, SAFE, Union Bakery Education Service District, State Architect Land Board are some examples that were, these are not cases that can be done very quickly. They require a lot of manpower and intense time to go through to put together a good case. Public official misconduct cases pretty much relatively stay pretty stable. We do get a lot of requests on conflict of interest cases from other agencies. I just had two come in yesterday where they felt that if they investigated, it would be improper that some accusations could be made, so they asked us to be kind of the outside party to come in and investigate that when it may relate back to an officer or a public official.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Captain, do the Pat Hearn's office at practice and standards, does he refer it to you, or do other people refer it directly to you, or and you get involved his office or not involved his office?
Madam Chair and Representative Wisnett, a lot of the cases that we get, usually it's the state agency coming directly to us because they have discovered something in their book work or something that they have noticed themselves, and we'll go in there. Patrick Hearn's office, like I said, a lot of the ethics violations and stuff, it rises to a level of a criminal type of deal. They'll contact us. Like I said, we also kind of pass football back and forth between Oregon DOJ as well, depending on resources and the type of cases we've got. We've often swapped cases, and again, we've often paired up because if I can use a couple of OSP investigators and maybe one or two DOJ investigators and get a four-man task force going, it doesn't impact me as much, and we're able to get through it pretty well.
Okay. Madam Chair. Bob, just while we've got a break here, I probably asked this, or you probably explained it to us, but tell us again, major crime, what is a major crime? What is the criteria for that? Murder, you know, armed, using a weapon, or what define it?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, major crime, we call it major crime section because we usually end up doing, the majority of the cases we do are crimes against persons, would be the best way, sexual assaults, rapes, homicides. You know, we don't do a lot of the robberies. Most of the banks are in the cities, counties. They do those types of deals. So really, it's pretty much a lot of the major crimes, child abuse cases, crimes that impact persons. We don't do a lot of the property crimes unless they're usually from a government agency type of deal.
Madam Chair.
Certainly.
But the Baker Union, that was an exception.
The Union Baker, yes.
Because federals weren't, the feds were involved. In.
Madam Chair, that is correct. It came through us on federal dollars.
Thank you.
Yes. Some of the other budget drivers, gasoline, I won't go into that. Vehicle maintenance, one thing, you know, in trying to do some budget cost savings, we are running our cars up from, used to be $80,000 up to $120,000 years back. In some aspects, it does save us from having to buy new cars, but we're starting to realize that about $100,000, there must be a piece or a part in a car when they start going out. We end up buying a lot of transmissions, seem to be gone, and that's a $2,000 to $3,000 a pop on that. That's been pretty much the biggest type of deal that we get into. Otherwise, or if a major engine maintenance type goes out, we really assess, you know, if we get 30,000 more miles for $1,000 more, or is it $2,000, we kind of take that into consideration or try to survey the car out and move on and replace it. Right now, with reductions from the last biennium, what we did is a lot of the cars that other detectives had that we vacated, we kind of have used them up through there. And what we're realizing is now I'm encountering, in my testimony here, I've got a bunch of cars that are around the same mileage point, all within 100 to 120,000 in my fleet. So obviously what that caused me to do is going to have to buy a bunch of cars in the beginning of the 0507 to replace some of these out. That's been one of the other issues we've had. As far as historical changes, I've got listed there in the biennium to the left in the positions. The positions have been kind of hard to tell because, as you know, from phase one, I have different entities within my division. Capital Mall office, I had the gaming enforcement division in my division at one point in time. So the numbers kind of fluctuate around as far as what's the actual number of criminal detectives I've had. For instance, as the major testified to in phase one, for the 0507, even though it says 135 positions, realistically, by the time you whittle it down to what are the actual criminal division resources, it comes out to 81 by the time you have the Capitol Mall office, Homeland Security, and our professional staff. So it has varied, a lot of it depending on what the agency has done by transferring a division or other entities in and out. So that's listed for your reference. Cost control measures, obviously the biggest thing what happens with us is the ability to, when we respond to a major crime, is trying to keep an eye on the overtime and how many people we send out depending on the need. Overtimes require supervisor approval. Anytime we do get a major crime call out, supervisor is notified. We'll respond as well and also try to ascertain what is the actual resource needs by a local agency or what our needs are. We've done some, tried to do some savings on doing some training. We have people who are experts, two instructors on this Trident interview and cognitive interview training. We did some regional training where we can send these two trainers around to do a 1 to 2 day inter region, invite other law enforcement agencies if the room is based on the capacity of the training location so that they are also willing and able to sit on that type and get that specialty type of training. We try to avoid live duplication and minimize costs through the continued participation in the interagency task forces, the major crime teams, the drug enforcement teams, working with each of those local agencies. Again, we continue to try to seek training costs and fees be shared with other agencies, as well as travel costs related to training and investigative costs for out-of-state travel as well. As far as the governor's recommended budget, package 090, I believe this has to do with 27 positions, of which six are from the Tobacco Compliance Task Force. That was five detectives and six positions on reduction of that. What that does on that piece is in phase two, the Tobacco Compliance Task Force, my enforcement branch, had a total of 10 sworn bodies and one office specialist. The phase two addition kind of gave us the ability to be able to do a little bit more, a lot more of these long-term, bigger types of cases because, again, a lot of these are a paper-driven case. It takes reams. We see boxes and boxes of documents from a business who have to go through to show the intent and stuff. Reduction of that obviously hampers some of our surveillance resources and efforts. It will hamper us in the ability of how many large-scale investigations we can do at one time. The reduction of 21 detectives from the criminal investigation, 10 are from the drug enforcement section, and 11 from the major crime section. These drug enforcement positions were ones that were assigned to interagency drug task forces throughout the state, and it's the major crime section positions also include one polygrapher position, a field operations sergeant, as well as 11 major crimes detectives. With the reduction, we had the previous session of 20 and this 21, that's a cut of 41. I've had to sit down with my folks and some of the local law enforcement agencies and say that we're really going to need to start kind of refocus what is it our capabilities of what we can do. One of the things that did come up is should we probably back out of the local child abuse investigations and doing other local investigative requests from city or county governments on public official investigations. That was pretty much based on a decision in 93. The legislature did fund 22 detective positions statewide to specifically work crimes against children. That's the first time when OSP actually entered into doing child abuse investigations statewide. With the reduction of the numbers now, with a lot of the other issues, the state institutions and meth and stuff, That was one piece. Some of the locals that we said that will still be there and provide assistance, but again, we probably have to do it on a geographic area to see what each need and each community's capabilities are to do that. A lot of our guys have become experts in this area and provide a lot of guidance on the more of the sensitive type cases. Again, major crime section in 2004 investigated 588 cases involving crimes against children. Package 101 had to do with actions recommended for 13 positions, dealing with reclassifying and reestablishing positions. These have been reviewed and approved by DAS, Human Resources Division. Package 111 was to maintain limited duration positions for the three HIDA administrative staff that oversee the HIDA program statewide. Not recommend that the package was restoration of the 20 general fund positions of the detectives. Package 122 adds 8 sworn investigators, which is 1 sergeant, 1 detective, for a special statewide investigative team focused on the purchase of chemicals used in the production of methamphetamine. A previous pilot project, what we did is we took one of our drug detectives and brought him into headquarters, and we worked with the Department of Justice on a lot of the receipts that we get on the iodine sales. Because we got the law to do it, the task forces just don't have the resources to go out and collect all these. So with the assistance of the National Guard, we went out to a lot of these stores and collected the receipts and looked at what raw intel information is there that we can be a little bit more efficient and more intel-driven on these types of cases. If you heard of the Damascus feed store case that we did up here up in Clackamas County last month, was probably about a 9-month project that it took our one detective to do. And part of the problems that we encountered, these types of cases, if you've seen on TV, the TV cameras are following these people going from store to store. It requires a lot of surveillance. And one of the problems that she became a little bit frustrated with was working with Clackamas County SIU and Rock, and they have other cases going and trying to grab them to say, can you help us on this case? Drug investigations, you need to kind of do it. That kind of became pretty evident that the drug task forces just don't have a lot of the time to do these types of cases. So what we basically said is, well, you know what? We'll try to put these cases together and work with the drug task forces and see if we can get to the lead problem of the methamphetamine issue, the chemicals that are involved, and see if we can do some reductions on that. There's obviously also a companion package in forensic services that complements that total position. Other than that, that is pretty much my testimony summarized, and I'll be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you very much, Captain. Questions? Comments? Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, I think yesterday, and maybe you did, I was out of the room for a couple of minutes, I wanted you to comment on the relationship with Department of Justice investigators and your investigators, because I think there's been some confusion a little bit about the role of DOJ and their criminal unit and your division's detective.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we've had an outstanding relationship with DOJ for many years. I know a lot of the guys over there. I think DOJ really looks at, they're the experts on doing a lot more of these RICO-type, bigger public corruption-type cases, election law violations and those types of deals. They've only got 8 to 10 investigators. That's why a lot of times if we do get into a case, we'll end up marrying. Sometimes in the past, we have assigned an OSP investigator to assist them. In one particular case where they assisted me is an internal investigation on a drug task force we were a part of. It was nice to have them because they weren't associated, and that they were able to come in and review the if there were criminal allegations in that drug task force. So we kind of really, on a case-by-case basis, depending on what the needs are, they have some a couple of financial investigators that they use. So a lot of their stuff has to do with the organized crime, public corruption type cases, which we don't get in, but we do assist them if that suffices. Other than that, I'm not sure you asked me to touch on, the LFO asked me to touch on the relationship with their investigative intel center. The DOJ Intel Center is the intel center recognized in this state by all law enforcement. The federal government knows that we have it. When we built the center, we wanted to make it a one-stop shopping center so you don't have a lot of these separate databases, stovepipes we call them. So like I said, enhancing work with DOJ with the HIDA project, we use HIDA funds to really enhance that. People can sit at a computer and do inquiries and submissions. saving a lot of time. It's connected to the Five Western States project, which is connected to the RIST project, which is nationwide. So I feel we've, when we sat down with them with a height of funds, we came together. I would very proud to say it's a model Intel Center for the nation.
Additional comments, questions? Well, Captain, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Again, for your time and also your hard work in preparation for this hearing. Thank you very much. Director of the Patrol Division, Captain Jerry Gregg. Good afternoon, Captain.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gerald Gregg. I'm a director of the Patrol Services Division. I've been a state trooper for 23 years and had held a number of operational field positions before being assuming my current duty assignment on October 1st of 2004. As the other divisions have done, we'll focus on the budget drivers and environmental factors. I'll preface that by saying the goal of the Patrol Services Division is to make Oregon highways safer. One of the primary ways that we do that is through high visibility, high contact patrol efforts. One of the most significant budget drivers and environmental factors that we face is the number of Oregon vehicle miles traveled on state highways. On page one, you'll see a chart which shows a significant increase in the number of miles that are being traveled on Oregon's highways since 1980. Another significant factor is a population increase Oregon has experienced since 1980, about a 35% increase. During this same time, the number of licensed drivers in Oregon has increased by 45%, and the number of vehicles registered has increased by 57%. So obviously there's more people with more cars than there were in years past. These types of demographics over the last 20 years have increased about 2% a year. Another significant budget driver, is, as was mentioned earlier by the other divisions, is the fuel costs. It has risen so fast in the last few months, I can't even keep the document current in terms of the difference between what we're budgeted and what we're having to pay at the pumps. Coinciding with all these increase demographics has been the significant decrease in the number of patrol division personnel resources in the last several years. This increased vehicles, miles traveled, and congestion on state highways and roadways has led to a significant increase in the number of driving complaints. On page 3, you'll see that the number of driving complaints to the Oregon State Police Dispatch Centers has risen from 10,495 in 1997 to 38,000 in 2004. At this trend, we'll have over 40,000 driving complaints. Certainly, that is driven in part by the number of cell phones. It's become a common personal item for many citizens in Oregon. So just the increased number of cell phones makes it more readily available for people to call us. However, what's interesting to note is in 2003, there were approximately 17,000 driving complaints that we just didn't have the personnel to respond to. In fact, this morning, we had a driving complaint of a reckless driver northbound on I-5, and the superintendent heard it on the radio, and he waited on the on-ramp between here and Portland trying to locate the car. So, I mean, they're happening all around us every day. The use of our highways by... Pardon me.
Before you go on, let me ask you about cell phone-related accidents. Do you have data that tells us... what that looks like over the last, 2003 forward. And also, in addition to cell phone related accidents, cell phone related deaths on the highways, roads.
Yes, Madam Chair, are you referring to accidents where a use of a cell phone would be considered a contributing factor in the cause of the crash? I don't have that data. We'll research that for you.
If you would.
Yeah.
And I'd like to know, as you're researching it, I'm assuming that you keep that data now, just as a matter of course.
If the use of a cell phone is identified as a contributing factor or causing the crash, then it would be coded on the crash report we do.
But I
know that there's a lot of discussion about, you know, how much of a distraction these cause, even using hands-free kits, but I don't have that data available, but we'll check and see what we can come up with.
I'm glad you mentioned hands-free. Would you also add that category?
And I'm not sure there's any differentiation between the two, but we'll check and see.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Very good.
Another significant...
Senator Devlin has a question for you.
Just a question, actually, in the terms of... Prior sessions, I used to spend a lot of sessions on the Transportation Committee, and I know that's, I don't know how many years it's been, but it's been a number of years since they developed the new form that you've been using for traffic accidents, where you can literally check off a whole lot of things in terms of, rather than having to fill out so much in detail, and some of the stuff, when you fill it out in detail, doesn't get covered. But just out of curiosity, because it's been an issue we've dealt with in transportation before, when you're on a fatality accident, how much time do you usually have to determine, I mean, obviously after the other authorities have come there, to determine what the cause of the accident was, or to look into in any great detail? And I know you actually have state troopers that are trained in accident recreation. But we've always found in the past, when we've looked in that committee at different issues about trying to determine why accidents occur, that they're, and it's not just Oregon, it's hard to find data for a lot of different factors.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, in the situation involving a fatal crash, that would determine to a great deal, and the spread could be incredible depending on the circumstances of a crash. If we have a single vehicle that runs off the road and crashes into a tree, for example, and we determine that that the driver was impaired to drugs or alcohol, that's certainly much less problematic. However, in many cases, our accident reconstruction, in all cases, our accident reconstructionists will look at potential mechanical failures of the vehicle in that scenario I just described. Perhaps it could be a combination of the two. Certainly the person was impaired, but there could be a mechanical failure. And much to the chagrin of members of the public and families, in some cases, we just will not declare or make a determination until we've completed our investigation. And much of that work is done after the fact. Our objective is to clear the highways as soon as we possibly can and restore the orderly flow of traffic. But we might seize those vehicles and take them to an impound yard and do a mechanical inspection of them. Crash that probably you're all familiar with was a horrific crash on Thanksgiving weekend at I-5. It took us a considerable amount of time to try to determine all the contributing factors, because there could be certainly more than one in any given crash.
Thank you. Madam Chair, the reason I brought it up, and it's different from Ways and Means question, is your question about cell phones. We've had questions before, and I know this, the new way you're reporting accidents, the work that you're doing is giving us more data. But we were in a committee looking at issues relative to, vehicle factors. Brakes not having been maintained, tires not, being bald. If we had any real data on those things, and this was several years ago, and problem was is we didn't really have much data that we could use.
On your minor crashes, in many cases, there's not a significant investigation, a detailed investigation into that. But if somebody says, "Gee, I don't know what happened. I think my brakes fail," then we are going to go one step further and start checking those.
Madam Chair, I'll stop, and I think the captain will agree that speed and liquor consumption are still pretty high on the.
I'll cover that shortly in my presentation. Another budget driving and environmental factor that we face is the commercial truck traffic in Oregon. Trucks travel more than 2 billion miles and move an estimated 250 to 300 million tons of freight on Oregon highways. In 2004, there were 1,779 truck crashes in Oregon, with 999 where the drivers were determined to be at fault. We have partnered closely with the Department of Transportation Motor Carrier Division to try to enhance truck safety. We require all of our troopers to do a minimum of 32 truck inspections in order to maintain their certification, and actually the benchmark is for a higher number of truck inspections on that. These truck inspections are based on probable cause stops. We're not looking for, mechanical problems as much as we are driver error. These probable cause stops, much different than the inspections at the weigh scales, the level one inspections. I know there's been some confusion in terms of the crash rates and fatal crash rates in Oregon. In 2003, there were 512 fatal crashes in Oregon, a 17.4% increase over 2002. We had a good year in 2004. It was down to 457, but 2005 were above the 2004 mark for this same period during the year. Overall, there's an average. The trend is a 12% increase. My staff has prepared new line graphs with the trends that I'd be happy to distribute to the committee when we're finished here. But the reality of it is we're still losing, somewhere around 500 people on Oregon highways every year. And in addition to that, let me back up. As you mentioned earlier, Senator Devlin, the primary causes of those fatal crashes are impaired driving, excessive speed, and failure to use occupant restraints, either seat belts, child safety seats, and so on. On page 4, DUI arrest, showed the chart there. Let me just suffice to say that drug and alcohol impairment remains a significant problem in Oregon, and it remains one of the highest priorities of the Oregon State Police Patrol Division. Number of DUID, driving under the influence of drugs or impairment other than alcohol, has seen an alarming increase. There were 1,289 such arrests in 2003. That's in part driven by the fact that we have a very, very top-notch drug recognition expert program. We're training more officers. We're trying to equip the officers on the street, both at the cities, the counties, and the Oregon State Police, to be able to identify the substance that causes the impairment, and thus being able to make an arrest that will result in prosecution.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Chair. Captain, would your agency have total DUI or DUID? I mean, my question, I guess, goes with, you've had a reduction in troopers, and so your number of DUI has gone down. Have the counties picked up any of that, or the cities picked up any of that in your absence? Have they increased their patrol, or would the total DUI arrests be the same or up or down?
Madam Chair, Senator, Representative Hanna, I don't have that information, but we'll get it for you. My sense is that it remains a high priority for all police agencies. Nobody's turning their back on an impaired driver. However, the cities and counties, that is in large part driven by their discretionary patrol time. If they're running from call to call, that's going to influence the ability of them to focus on impaired driving enforcement.
Yeah.
But we'll get you that number.
Yeah, it just makes you wonder totally what they're doing, or if some of the slack got picked up in those other agencies. Thank you.
You're welcome. Another budget driver and environmental impact, and I'll just refer to it briefly on page 5, is the economic impacts as a result of crashes and fatalities. It's an enormous impact on society. With that said, proactive traffic enforcement will continue to be an effective strategy to prevent and detect the transportation of drugs, illegal narcotics, weapons, criminal activity, and so on Oregon highways. Captain Nally referenced and referred to the problem with clandestine methamphetamine labs, marijuana grows in Oregon, a drug-related deaths are up in Oregon, and we're seeing significant amounts of criminal activity and narcotics as a result of our traffic stops. You can see at the bottom of page 5 that in 2004 you can see the statistical results of criminal arrests and seizures that were made as a result of our traffic stops. Recently, here in Salem, within the last 2 months, we had a sergeant make a traffic stop. He found 323 pounds of marijuana being transported to California. A couple weeks before that, he had the biggest seizure of ecstasy tablets in Oregon, 9,876. Night before last, made a traffic stop and found 25 gallons of meth oil. And last night, we found on a traffic stop a 11 grams of heroin, some methamphetamine needles, and $25,000 in cash. I mean, these are just recent things that are happening all around us. All of that on the I-5 corridor.
It's amazing that you are able to be proactive, using your word, which is also printed here. It's amazing that you're able to be proactive with so few patrol officers.
Madam Chair, to that I can only say thank you on behalf of the staff, because they're out there and they're working very hard to focus on our priority areas. I mean, they know that anything we can do to impact the safety on Oregon highways is their job, and they're out there doing the best they can to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing that we've done in order
that
to...
I would also like to add to that, you've got to be stretched.
We are.
In your efforts to be proactive. And so please be very clear with us about what that looks like and what that means for your officers who are, they're being proactive and effective, but...
Madam Chair, I guess to that I would respond that if given the few number of patrols we have out there that are able to detect and apprehend these elements, this criminal activity, if we had adequate patrol staffing, I think we would be even more successful, significantly more successful, incredibly so. I mean, it's out there. You know, these are just, I mean, you just stop a car and in the case of the 25 gallons of meth oil, the guy pulled off to the side of the road and had his flashers on. We thought we were stopping to assist a disabled motorist. We'll take it any way we can get it when it involves this kind of thing. One thing that the department has done to try to, the patrol nurse has done to try to combat this problem of the criminal activity is we have two patrol canines that we've recently partnered with the criminal division and put into play. And in fact, one of the dogs was involved in the seizure of the meth oil. Juvenile crime and it remains a significant concern to the department. And in 2003-2004, we issued over 7,000 citations to juveniles, charged more than 1,000 juveniles with criminal offenses, including drug, alcohol, stolen vehicles, and so on. Historical changes. The graph on page 7 shows that in 1980 we had 641 troopers and sergeants. In the patrol division, we're currently authorized 311. So you can see the downward trend on our staffing. That decline in personnel has caused us some setbacks. There are currently no patrol stations with 24-hour-a-day coverage. None of our work sites have it. In the past, years past, they all were, and then we sort of migrated to where the major area command sites had 24-hour-a-day coverage. The outposts often didn't, but the area commands would make up the slack, and now we don't have anybody working 24-hour-a-day coverage. We schedule, depending on the size of the office, until 2, 3, 4 in the morning, but as you all know, just because we schedule them doesn't mean that on every scheduled shift, people get sick, they take vacation leave, they have to go to training, so there's many times when we have even greater gaps than the 2, 3, 4 hours a day. In many occasions, our troopers are out there working by themselves. It's an obvious officer safety issue and one that concerns us deeply. There's certainly a reduction in the investigation of minor property crimes, and I use that term very carefully. Even though it's a minor crime, a property crime, that's a significant event, and in many cases a traumatic experience to the victims, and in many cases we just don't have the resources to investigate those, not unlike some of our partner agencies at the cities and counties. Troopers and sergeants are spending more time than they ever have in the past on administrative duties. One of the more obvious and significant ones is evidence lockers are being maintained by sworn staff. We spent about 26,000 hours thus far in the 03-05 biennium of sworn officer staff, either lieutenants, troopers, or sergeants, in maintaining these evidence lockers because we lost the evidence tax in the budget cuts. We're also running our vehicles to 120,000 miles. We used to turn them in at 90, and we've been moved up to 120, and of course there's a significant increased maintenance cost on some of those vehicles. Some of them we get lucky and we get by, but others it costs us a lot more money to get them there, and some we just can't get them there. And with all that being said, and sort of a little bit back to what you mentioned earlier, Madam Chair, is that with all that said, the department continues to rise to the challenge and work diligently to provide high-quality law enforcement services to the citizens of Oregon. At the bottom of page 8, you'll see some examples of some of our successes over the last couple years. Number of calls for service, number of DUIs arrested, 317,000 traffic citations, 378,000 warnings, trucks inspected, 54,000 motorists assisted, crashes investigated. We did implement an aggressive driving enforcement program, which has been extremely successful in terms of identifying the very aggressive, dangerous drivers out there. And then I mentioned the canine program as well.
Captain, I want to go back to the officer safety issue that comes about because we don't have enough troopers, and that results in troopers working by themselves, as you pointed out. In your text here, it says this is troopers working by themselves. This is an obvious officer safety issue. And I guess it's obvious, and then again, maybe it isn't obvious enough. And so I want to make sure that we make a record today of what this means. What this means out in the field for the officers whose safety is jeopardized because we don't have enough troopers. Provide some examples.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll date myself a little bit here, but in 1980 I was a dispatcher at our comm center at the time was what it was called at Portland, and I would work either swing shift, for example, and one of my responsibilities was to dispatch for Portland, the Portland office, the Clackamas office, the McMinnville office, the Columbia City office. I then was assigned as a trooper to Columbia City, which is now located in St. Helens. That patrol area is the width of one highway and 70 miles long. When I would start my shift at as a dispatcher, there would be 3-4 officers on shift in Columbia City, for example. And then the swing shift would go home in Graveyard, come on, and there would be 2 or 3 on duty on any given day. I went there as a trooper, and in most cases we had two troopers assigned to any given shift on any given day. And that was if there were no problems and everybody made it and got to work. So with that example, in many cases I worked alone, and there was no other state trooper on in the immediate area that was listening to the radio traffic and monitoring what was going on when I made traffic stops. And if I got into a bind, which there were a couple times I did, then we relied on our partner agencies, the sheriff's office or the city police, to provide cover and assistance. And Columbia County Sheriff's Office is incredibly understaffed as well. So the bottom line is, if you needed help out there because you ran into a problem on a traffic stop, it wasn't often close. I can think of one example where it was a very long 8 minutes before somebody showed up. And, you know, I, quite frankly, I had to become very quickly a silver-tongued devil and manage to keep the discussion going and avoid a physical confrontation. But those examples are, at that particular time when the Portland office, like shift change, you know, graveyard would have 8 or 10 troops, and swing shift might have 10 or 12. Today, the Portland office putting out normally 2 troops a shift. You know, Baker City, Pendleton, if they've got one or two patrols on at any given shift on any given day, they're doing great. And there just isn't anybody out there listening to that radio that can detect the tone of your voice and think, you know, that's not right. I'm heading that direction. You know, and our dispatchers are great. They pay attention to that kind of thing. But you know, if you're halfway between LeGrand and Baker City or up on Meacham Pass and you need help, and they've got to get a hold of some other agency to come help us, it's an increased response time. Mm-hmm. So I hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Representative Hanna.
Captain, the new vehicles, thank you, Madam Chair, the vehicles that you see on the road now that are, I think they're ODOT or Department of Transportation, incident response, I know you're doing a whole bunch of, you know, disabled motorists stop and help. Do those folks fill any of that gap for you?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, the ODOT, either COMET program, I think is the primary one you would be referring to. They also have some vehicles which are incident response. And I can tell you the incident response in most cases, if, for example, if we have a crash that blocks a highway, we partner with ODOT, and they send out resources so that our troopers can focus on the investigation of the crash, and they can help us with traffic control, diverting traffic, redirecting traffic, cleaning up the scene, making necessary repairs to guardrails. But in certain areas, they have what's called a COMET truck. For example, within the city of Portland, we stopped patrolling those freeways within the city of Portland in 1981. Portland Police Bureau does not proactively or normally patrol those freeways. They will respond to a crash or something out there on those freeways that either COMET can't clear or that has injuries that requires a police investigation and response. So within the Portland area, COMET is very active in terms of picking up the slack in areas where there's not adequate and regular police patrol. They do assist us in some of those areas, for example, 205, South End, I-5, and so on. But they can do a lot of things. For example, they carry water, they carry fuel on board, things that we can't
put
in a standard sedan. The problem is, I mentioned earlier that, you know, 2 days ago a trooper pulled up behind what he thought was a disabled motorist, and we've got 25 gallons of meth oil in the vehicle. So, but yes, there is some crossover there.
Well, Madam Chair, follow up. I just wondered if there was a way to supplement so that you're not putting gas in somebody's car. Those folks are. You're not, you know, jump starting somebody. Somebody else is. And I know that doesn't work in, you know, Harney County someplace, but in the major traffic areas, if that was a way to free up some time. And then, of course, like you say, you can also stumble on something pretty important at the same time. So,
well, we're always cognizant when we walk up on a car, even if it's a disabled motorist. You know, we think we're there to be the good guy, but we don't know what we're walking into, and that concerns us.
If I could, Mr. Durbin, if I could just add something here. There has been a lot of discussions about this situation, and one of the things that the state police is concerned about is that oftentimes these vehicles that are on the sides of the road are stolen vehicles, they're hauling drugs, they have a driver or individuals that are in under the influence, a wanted person. One case that just happened a few months ago out of Chemult, a vehicle had gone into the snowbank, and some individuals pulled over to offer some assistance, called a tow truck. The individual that had lost control in the snowbank had just killed his 2 roommates in Washington and then murdered the tow truck driver when he was there. Now, that has caused not only the state police, which we are well aware of these issues, but also the Department of Transportation to take a real look at, you know, the service that they're providing and the risk that they're placing their members in danger of. So.
We have about 10 minutes remaining. If you can walk us through the rest of it.
Hurry right through that.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the historical changes, just quickly, reduction in our authorized strength. We lost 175 positions in 2003, caused some setbacks, nonetheless some accomplishments. Cost control measures, we've reassigned vehicles wherever possible to individual officers, which gives them an opportunity to spend more time on patrol and less time in patrol prep and termination. Equipment maintenance, vehicle assigned to a single individual, our maintenance costs are lower. We've conducted a fleet audit for the reassignment of vehicles. We've surveyed unnecessary vehicles and are making better use of the vehicles. We've added an employee and patrol division with self-administering funds to coordinate the tow programs, which allows the sworn supervisor to perform other law enforcement functions. We're reassigning the collision reconstruction program to patrol sergeants so that the lieutenant assigned to patrol division can better fill budgetary and operational related functions. We've continued the oversight of the drug recognition expert program or evaluator program, and we've assigned a sergeant to take care of that. Anytime a lease comes up for renewal, we evaluate all of our facilities and whether or not we can consolidate and do better with that. And we've used, where appropriate, the Homeland Security grants to utilize for training and equipment. Governor's recommended budget package 090 shifts funding for 301 general fund trooper positions to the lottery funds. The net result is 329 sworn positions for the patrol division, with 28 being funded by other funds. 101 is a reclassification and general fund position reductions to pay for them. The net result is the elimination of 14 positions. Those positions are 5 sergeants and 9 seasonal cadets. 102, as modified, established the one position which I mentioned earlier on the tow program. Program requires administrative oversight and will be self-supporting. It's a program rep one, but was approved as a trooper position. And the request in that package for 2 cadets to work the front desk reception at general headquarters was not approved. What are the impacts to the budget? Well, quite frankly, it's we have continued inadequate staffing at all the offices in the field offices in terms of 24-day coverage. We don't have enough troopers to provide adequate patrol coverage. Crashes and emergencies requiring law enforcement response, impaired driving, and criminal activity occurs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in Oregon. About 10% of our calls for service are between midnight and 6 a.m. when our staffing is weakest. We're talking about delayed response or imposition on other agencies to respond for emergencies to help us out. And in times when we don't have anybody out, we're just not proactive and we're not out there detecting and apprehending problems. And we'll continue to utilize trooper sergeants and lieutenants to minimally maintain the evidence lockers, coordinate vehicle maintenance, and other duties. Madam Chair, if I could quickly close. Over the past 5 years, the Patrol Services Division has been reduced from 542 to 329. I mentioned we don't have 24-hour day coverage, and as a result, we don't have the ability to provide adequate patrols to prevent or to act as a deterrent to crimes and traffic problems on our state highways. I just want to again try to clear up that over the past 5 years, if you look at crash rates, total crashes or fatal crashes are all on the rise, and I'll provide those charts to you. And we could do better on crash rates if we had adequate patrol coverage out there. Driving complaints, I mentioned, they're way up. Criminal complaints are up. And I just want to mention that one area which is a success story where we had a better emphasis enforcement effort was on the motor carrier safety, where that trend line isn't going up. It's pretty much flat. So I thank you for your time.
Sir, I would like to make sure I understand what you're describing in the paragraph that starts continued inadequate staffing level in all field offices. The last 2 sentences read, under current circumstances, there is either a delayed response or imposition on other agencies to respond. That's between the midnight to 6 a.m. period. But then the last sentence says, there is a complete elimination of enforcement activity during these times. Are you saying that there's no enforcement in between midnight and 6 on the part of the...
No, Madam Chair, let me clarify. What I meant by that was at times when we don't have a trooper on duty, in, unless there's an emergency call. Let me give you, for example, we'll talk about Tillamook County. We schedule our troopers until midnight or 2 a.m. If there's a crash on a state highway, the sheriff's office, if they happen to have somebody on and in the area, might go out and check on that, and depending on the circumstances, call us so we can call a trooper at home who can then get in their car and head out and take care of the crash. Or in some cases, our partner agency will take care of it for us if it's not a significant event and they have the time and resources to do it. But during those times, let's say, for example, Tillamook had no one working between midnight and 6 a.m. If there weren't that crash or that emergency, if we're just talking about the impaired driver driving down the road or the speeder going down the road or the guy carrying drugs or money down the road, then we have no proactive enforcement out there during those hours when we have no troopers on duty. And that's what I meant by that.
All right. Further questions or comments?
If we've got time, I think the major was going to, I'd ask him to talk about the House co-chair gave him additional $5 million, and we talked about a meth task force, and how, and I think the major may have some recommendation on how he would use that money or how he would help us with the meth problem, because I think, you know, we've got all these bills in the building, and all during the session, meth has been the top priority. But if we don't put any money to the meth, we're not going to, just to pass a bill doesn't help if we can't put some more patrolmen out there or increase the criminal division or something. So I'm glad to see that the House co-chair put some additional money, and maybe we could utilize that by supporting some increase in the state police.
Mr. Wilson?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I want to make sure you understand that that's a pot of money not just for the state police, but, for example, if a crime was, a sentence was increased, it would be also for DOC in terms of incarceration costs or treatment dollars or whatever. I think they put it there because that's where the meth money was in the governor's budget. So just in that context, I want to make sure the members knew the context of where the co-chairs was putting the money.
They didn't tell us that.
That's my understanding.
Major, would you like to respond now, or do you need more time? Because we can pick this up tomorrow when we begin. In addition to, you also gave us responses to questions from the subcommittee going back to our meeting in February. And it would be useful, I think, to walk through these questions and responses just to make sure that the members are satisfied in the way that in which you have handled the responses.
Okay, would you like us to return tomorrow then?
That's what I'm suggesting. I am. Sir?
Madam Chair, with your permission, I'll give members of the committee the line graphs and
please.
The trend lines.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair,
Representative Hannah.
This is just a question, and I don't expect the captain to answer in less than 1 minute, but when I hear the captain speak of, you know, no OSP officer on the road, crash happens, another agency shows up, and then they call for you, OSP, to come take care of that, I can't help but think, how does that work? And we've all probably seen this, but especially if you drive south, these other agencies that are on the road doing speed enforcement, what responsibility do they take to crash enforcement? You don't have to do that now, but I'd like to know what that.
Madam Chair, I could probably answer pretty briefly. In many cases, officers assigned to traffic teams, they focus on stopping cars and writing tickets. They don't respond to those emergencies.
Including other agency,
yes.
i.e. Coburg?
Yes.
So they have no responsibility to crash?
there have been many cases where our troopers responded to a crash and traveled some distance to get there as quickly as they could and passed a traffic deputy from another agency or a traffic officer from a city office that their objective, their directive from their agency is you don't respond to calls, you work traffic. And that could be an emergency call of a domestic violence situation.
Thank you.
And if I could add a little bit further on this, many of our troopers, most of our troopers take vehicles home and they respond to call outs. So we have entered into agreements with most of the counties because that's our primary responsibility. If there's a serious injury, crash, or a fatality on an area of our responsibility, we'll respond. So now we call our members out on their days off or on their time off and pay them overtime to investigate that crash.
Well, as a closing comment, I just feel moved to say this. You know, in Oregon, I'm an Oregon native, and I don't mind telling you that I've been here for 58 years. And it just really, it pains me. I just think it's just so shameful that we are allowing the diminishment of services to Oregonians, whether we're talking education, whether we're talking human services, or we're talking Oregon State Police and the role that you play in public safety. There was a headline in the Oregonian a couple of weeks or so ago indicating that Oregon is rated average among the states. We are better than that. We must be better than that. We are settling for mediocrity, and I find that just totally, totally unacceptable. And now I'm going to get off my soapbox and we're adjourned. Mr.
Madam Chair, just for housekeeping, next Wednesday will be the public testimony day for the state police. And also on Monday, the meeting on Monday is not in this building. It's in the Anderson Readiness Center, which is a mile and a half east of here on State Street, and we'll arrange transportation with your offices if you need it. That will be the Homeland Security Department. It's going to be held out there. And actually, it will be a quick tour, which probably will include the State Police Dispatch Center, which is one of their two dispatch centers, which is located there, too.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. I do want to serve notice that I will be getting back on my soapbox before this is all over.